This is lecture number 10 of Alan McRae's course, Prophecies in Daniel, that he gave back in the 1970s. Again, lecture number 10. I wanted to bring out to you the fact that this word, Messiah, or Anointed One, is used in the Old Testament for a king in about half the cases it is used. It's used for the people of Israel in a number of ways. It's used for priests in four or five cases. It is used even for a prophet in a couple of cases. It is used for a king in about half the cases where it is used. Now, here's a commentary, and it is called The Prophecy of Daniel by E.J. Young, and it's a commentary that has some very good things in it. Dr. Young has made a very thorough study of the book of Daniel, and when he is not prejudiced on certain points, his material is often of great value. But there are a few points where he has great prejudices, in my opinion, and when covering a debated subject like that, he sometimes jumps to conclusions rather quickly. Here he makes the statement that in the verse which I referred to you in Daniel 9, verse 25, where it says, quote, Messiah the Prince, end quote, he says, and I'm quoting now from his commentary, this must refer to Christ. It must be a prediction of Christ because he is the only one who was both a king and a priest. End quote. Well, now, in the phrase, quote, Messiah the Prince, end quote, the word prince suggests that it is referring to the king. But does Messiah mean it is referring to a priest? Well, if you have gathered your own evidence by looking at the use of the word Messiah in the Hebrew or in the Old Testament, you'll find that the Hebrew word Messiah is translated as anointed in most cases, and in half the cases it is used of a king. So the term Messiah the Prince might be one who is a king and a priest, but it doesn't have to be. It simply is one whom God has set apart for an important task. So in that verse, whether it is talking about Christ or not, is a matter to be decided on other grounds and not simply to be decided by the fact that the King James Version uses this term, Messiah the Prince, or is it to be decided by an inadequate argument such as this one, which unfortunately Dr. Young has given. As you see, as you look at the original Hebrew, Dr. Young's argument looks quite out of place. Now, so much for that assignment, although I should mention that the next assignment deals with those same verses in chapter 9 where Messiah is used. It's a brief passage which has had a tremendous amount of discussion in the Christian world. And it only relates to one verse in the passage, and the assignment is quite a simple thing which you could probably do in a few minutes, but which I'm afraid I've taken longer to explain than what it's going to take you to do it. And so that I don't take any more time discussing the assignment, I have placed three copies of it on the bulletin board. And I believe once you read it, you will have practically all of it in mind. So we don't need to spend any more time on what is already on the board. Now, we are looking at Daniel chapter 11. The last two lectures, we spent quite a bit of time in Daniel chapter 11. And Daniel 11, as we have noticed, contains a great many statements which would be very difficult to interpret in advance, but they are statements which, when the events occurred, some of them you could say fit this particular historical context very well. But as I said, you would not be able to fit it by looking ahead on what was going to happen, but only afterwards as you know the history. But I hasten to say, once you see the history, you see how accurately Daniel had prophesied the events. But there are other statements which fit very specifically only one historical situation. And we notice in chapter 11 how it starts in verse 2 and refers to the fact that, quote, there will be yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth will be far richer than all of them. And by his strength, through his riches, he will stir up all against the realm of Greece, end quote. And you would not know exactly what is going to happen if you lived in Daniel's days, although you could form a pretty good guess that there would be three more kings of Persia, and the fourth one would be richer than any of the previous three ones. And, indeed, historically, that was the case for Xerxes, who was to make a great attack on Greece. he was richer than the previous kings. And it was the greatest attack, perhaps, that has ever been made on Greece. Perhaps one of the greatest attacks in all history was that tremendous army which Xerxes turned against Greece. He made such an impression on the Greeks from their managing to survive that attack that it was very important in all their thinking 200 years later. They were psychologically prepared for Alexander the Great to go back into Persia and attack the Persian Empire and destroy it. And then the third verse, again of chapter 11 of Daniel, we notice, quote, "A mighty king shall arise who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will," end quote. And of course, this could be said of many different people, but the following verse speaks specifically about Alexander the Great, and so we know that verse 3 here was a description of Alexander the Great, the mightiest king the world had perhaps seen up to that time, who nothing seemed to be able to stand before him. But you notice between verse 2 and verse 3, there is an unmentioned interval of over 150 years. Daniel simply passes from Xerxes, who attacked Greece, to Alexander the Great, who destroyed the Persian Empire. Daniel skips over 150 years without any reference to this time period. Then, going on to verse 4, Daniel tells about the division of Alexander's empire. In advance, it might be hard to know exactly what is meant by the phrase, quote, "And when he stood up, his kingdom will be broken," end quote. In other words, he didn't have his power very long. He was just a young fellow in his early 30s, and then he died rather suddenly. And his kingdom, after he died, was broken, although they tried to keep it together, but they soon got to fighting amongst themselves. Pretty soon, it was divided into three large important sections and a few smaller sections. So it was divided, not according to the dominion of his rule, nor according to his posterity, for within the next 15 years, every single relative of Alexander the Great, his mother, his brothers, his children, every relative of his was killed. His kingdom was not according to his posterity or the dominion of which he ruled, as it was given to others. That is to say, none of his relatives, and frankly, ultimately, none of his close friends was able to completely hold the kingdom. Well, let's move on to verse 5. Again, we're in Daniel chapter 11, and we read, quote, "The king of the south shall be strong," end quote. "And one of his," that is one of Alexander's generals, who took the most southern part of his empire, Ptolemy, who took Egypt, was a very strong king. You couldn't have predicted exactly what this would mean in the future, but when it came to pass, you could well say, looking back on the prophecy, something like, quote, "Well, isn't this wonderful that Daniel predicted this 300 years in advance," end quote. But then we continue with Daniel's description of what's going to happen to Ptolemy. And again, I'm quoting, "The king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes shall be strong above him and have dominion," end quote. And when you find one of Ptolemy's generals, Seleucus, or Seleucus, you can pronounce his name either way, Seleucus went up and he got control of the whole eastern half of the Persian Empire, that certainly would be a remarkable fulfillment of this prophecy. Again, you wouldn't know in advance what was going to happen, but when it did happen, you could see how tremendously accurately Daniel had predicted this history. Quote, "He shall be strong above him," end quote. This refers to Seleucus, who had a far wider area than Ptolemy when all was finished. And so this part of the prophecy fits, quote, "And have dominion, his dominion will be a great dominion," end quote. That latter phrase that I just quoted referring to Seleucus. Verse 6, and again I quote, "In the end of years, they will join themselves together, for the king's daughter of the south will come to the king of the north to make an agreement," end quote. Here between verses 5 and 6, you skip over Seleucus' son, and you skip to his grandson, and there is an unmentioned interval of about 30 years here. And then you find the attempt to bring the two portions of the prophecy together, and I quote, and the king's daughter of the south will come to the king of the north to make an agreement." End quote. Well, in the treaty, as you know, Bernice, the daughter of Ptolemy II, was married to Antiochus II. And again I quote, "But she shall not retain the power of her arm, neither shall he stand or his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begot her, and he that strengthened her in these times." End quote. And we took time last time to notice the conflict between Bernice and Seleucus' former wife. In the end, Bernice and her child were killed, and her father died in about the same time period. The man who married her was thought to be poisoned by his first wife. This is a very exact fulfillment of this prophecy. You might not know exactly how it would be in the future as you would look at it in the time of Daniel, but again, when it happened, you would say, how wonderful that Daniel could predict these details. On the verse 7, quote, "But out of a branch of her roots shall one stand up," end quote. This implies that descended from Bernice's ancestors, a rather poetic way to describe her brother, he indeed would come up with his army, and he did attack the north, and the next two verses we have this tremendous victory over the next king. And then in verse 10, referring to the king of the north, we read, quote, "His son shall be stirred up and assemble a great multitude," end quote. And the fighting between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies goes on through two or three verses, but then you have an account of the person we call Antiochus III, as we have already noticed before. We went through the details of Antiochus III's conquering Palestine specifically referred to here, and to the people in Israel who tried to help him, because many of them thought they would be freer under Antiochus than what they would be under Ptolemy. Unfortunately, that did not work out, as we will see in the future. We also mention Antiochus III's conflict with Rome, so we won't go over the same material here. But then in verse 20, we have his son, that is the son of Antiochus III, and we read, quote, "There shall stand in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle," end quote. I hate to keep saying this, but it would be hard to tell beforehand what is going to happen. But after it happened, we saw that Antiochus III had to pay such tremendous reparations to Rome that it was necessary that his son devote himself to trying to reestablish fiscal stability in the kingdom, and his son spent most of his time raising taxes and making up for the great expenses of his father. Yes, he raised the taxes, or he sent someone else to raise taxes. It could be either way, but his principal activity was reestablishing fiscal stability. And then in verse 21 and following, we notice that we have the account of Antiochus IV, who is also called Antiochus Epiphanes. We will have more to say about him as well. But at the end of the last hour, we discussed Antiochus Epiphanes' career, and I don't want to go over more details of it now. Again, I looked a couple of days ago at the latest edition of Encyclopedia Britannica. You may know that it was completely rewritten just a few years ago with an entirely different plan. And I look up the article on Antiochus IV, or Antiochus Epiphanes. In previous editions of Encyclopedia Britannica, they would continue articles from one edition to the other, and you really didn't know when the article was written. But if they thought it was good enough for one edition and no new information was available, they would use the same article in a subsequent edition. Now, if you've got the Encyclopedia Britannica from 10 years ago, and you don't know whether an article was written that year or 15 years before, well, things changed. And recently, the whole encyclopedia was re-edited, and some major changes were made. There were complete changes in some of the articles. And so I was interested to see what they would say about Antiochus IV and compare the recent edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica's description of Antiochus IV with what had been said in earlier editions. And they said that Antiochus was a very able king and very effective. and he was also an able fighter, but quite inadvertently he gave an occasion for the establishment of a Jewish state. That is quite a modernistic way of saying he tried to destroy the Jewish religion, and he took over the temple in Jerusalem and established the worship of pagan gods there. Antiochus IV killed Jews who would not sacrifice to idols, and he made things so terrible that we have the Maccabean uprising that developed, that resulted eventually in an independent Jewish state that lasted for about a century. It is easy to see the basis of the man who wrote that particular article about Antiochus. But the interesting thing is that in the beginning of the article we read, and I'm quoting here from the encyclopedia, Antiochus IV Epiphanes was also called Epimenes, end quote. And that is the only detrimental word that is said about Antiochus in the entire article, and unless you know Greek, it would not convey the meaning of the word Epimenes. Now, realize this is a play on words, Epiphanes, Epimenes. Antiochus called himself Epiphanes, Antiochus Epiphanes, which meant Antiochus the outshining god. All the Seleucid kings before this called themselves god, but he was the first one to put it on his coins. He put the word Epiphanes, that he was the outstanding god, on the coins. But his people saw his crazy antics, and we noticed that he would steal, for example, from a temple, and then he would throw the money around to the populace. He would kill somebody on just a crazy whim, and then he would take some other poor person and lift him up and give him lots of honors. He was very erratic in many ways, so the people, instead of calling him Epiphanes, the outshining god, they called him Epimenes, which means, quote, the mad or crazy one, end quote. Again, you see the play on words from Epiphanes to Epimenes. Well, this article in the encyclopedia was kind of funny how they said that he was also called Epimenes, but they didn't explain what that meant, and yet everything else they say about him is very favorable, as though, overall, he was a good king. Certainly, however, not from the Jewish perspective, but again, we'll get into that later. But the account of him that is given here in Daniel is not particularly favorable. As you can expect, when Antiochus IV tried to destroy all knowledge of God and to put a complete end to the Old Testament religion. Well, we saw various aspects of his life last time and noticed how they were carried out. So now, we want to go from number 2 to number 3 in the outline, which discusses what the Bible says about this time period. And so, on to number 3 of the outline, quote, the outline of Daniel, chapter 11, verse 21, to chapter 12, verse 3, end quote. Now, I've put some other figures up at the right in red of the diagram I'm showing you, and you don't need to worry much about them quite yet. I will explain their meaning later. But we read about Antiochus IV's character in verses 21 to 24, and in verses 36 to 39 in Daniel chapter 11. I will say more about verses 36 to 39 later on, but some people feel that these particular verses also refer to Antiochus. I do not think they do, for reasons that I will explain. But at any rate, we have another description of the character of this king. For example, in verse 25 to the end of the first half of verse 30, we read a general account of his political activities. And we have an account of the political activities of the king in verses 40 to 45. Or should I say, the political activities of a king in verses 40 to 45, because I do not think it is Antiochus Epiphanes that is being discussed here. But we read about the trouble and relief for God's people in the last part of verses 30 to 35. And in verses 1 to 3 in chapter 12, we have there what could be described as trouble and relief for God's people. So you go through three subjects about Antiochus, and then you again go through three subjects about what appears to be another king. And of course, according to the critical view, you are dealing with the same man. And you are told these things about Antiochus, and then you go over it all again with different words. This is their view. but it doesn't work out. So I have incidentally mentioned these figures here that we will speak about later. Now, let's go on briefly to mention a specific point of clear fulfillment. There are remarks made about him, that is Antiochus, as there are about other rulers that could be made about just about anybody who's a great conqueror. We won't concern ourselves particularly with them. They fit him so that they are a proper part of the prophecy. But we note civic matters, such as in verses 21 to 23, we find that he was not a legitimate ruler. We find that he came in by an unusual arrangement. Verse 21, again, chapter 11 of Daniel says, quote, "In his estate shall stand up a vile person," end quote. Vile in Old English doesn't mean necessarily a wicked person as it does today. It may simply mean a person of unworthy standing, a person who did not have the right to take what he got. In this case, Seleucus IV's son, who was a hostage in Rome, was the one who was, according to the laws, entitled to come over and become Antiochus IV's successor. But before he could come, a man who had killed Seleucus was trying to establish himself as ruler in the name of Seleucus' infant son. While that was being done, Antiochus IV managed to come in and kill the man who killed his brother and the child. He established himself as king, so you could say, quote, "In his estate shall stand up a vile person whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably," end quote. Peaceably here means that he did not make a conquest. He got the king of a neighboring area to lend him some money and help him to get there with a small force, and then came in and declared he was the son of Antiochus the Great, that is Antiochus III, and killed the murderer and took power before people realized what was going on. And he took over power, obtained the kingdom by flatteries, and he became strong with just a few people working with him. He worked deceitfully. These three verses tell about his succession, and they fit exactly him and would not really fit any other kings that we have looked at before. Then we find in verse 24 the strange contrast in his character. Quote, "He entered peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province," end quote. Now, this word peaceably here is more the idea of by stealth, by taking something without people realizing what was going on. He would take a hold of things and get into the temples and seize their treasures. He did that not only with the temples of Jerusalem, but with temples of various gods. He raised very large extractions with people who had very large amounts of money. Then he would scatter among them the prey and spoil of his riches. This was the man who made seizures and also squandered the money he got. This was typical of his character. He was not the only man who had such a contrast, but it was not very common. Then we have his attack on Egypt in verse 25 and following. Of course, many of the Seleucid kings made attacks on Egypt, but here we find out about the treasury of Pharaoh's supporters in verses 25 and 26. Those were supposed to be helping Antiochus's nephew, the legitimate king of Egypt, but he was a young boy and they conspired against him. Then we find in verse 27 where he told his nephew he was going to help him. Quote, "The two kings sat at one table telling lies," end quote, making the other think he would stand with him but was really against him. And then in the first part of verse 28 we read his return to his home, which is Antioch, with great wealth, but on the way back his heart was against the Holy Covenant, and he did exploits, end quote. The word exploits is inserted into the King James. He did things in Jerusalem and returned to his own land. He tried to rob the temple. He gave strict orders that the Jews were not to be circumcised and they were not to follow the Mosaic laws. He returned to Antioch with great wealth, but he returned to difficulty. And part of that difficulty was because he also went to Jerusalem and robbed the temple there. We have these matters predicted in such a way that you would not know exactly what was going to happen, but that when it did happen, you could see that it was indeed exactly fulfilled. Now, concerning his second invasion of Egypt, and we are still talking about Antiochus IV. You find this in verse 29 and following, which we looked at last time. Remember how the Roman emissary came and told Antiochus to withdraw from Egypt when he was about to have it all in his hands. So Antiochus said, well, I'll require some time to consider this. And the emissary from Rome said, you can consider it as long as you are in the circle that the emissary had drawn in the sand around Antiochus. And so he gave in to the Romans, but he was very, very much irritated by all this, and when he returned back to his homeland, he took it out on the Jews. And so we have in verse 30 the reference to, quote, the ships of Kittim, or Kittim, will come against him, end quote. Kittim is a word regularly used for the regions to the west in the Mediterranean. Therefore, Antiochus grieved, and he returned, but he was indignant against the Holy Covenant. And that was his reaction to all that had happened. It was partly to hold his great gains in Antioch, to which he invited people from all over the world, and on which he had spent a tremendous sum of money. It was to that he consolidated a scheme to try to unify his empire by requiring everybody to have the same religion in his empire, and that he would destroy other religions and insist that everybody would worship Zeus. And it was now that his army seized the temple in Jerusalem and so polluted it that no pious Jew could possibly go into it again until it had been purged and cleansed. So we have his severe persecution of Judaism described in verse 30, the second part of it, where we read, quote, so shall he do. He shall return and have favor on them that forsake the Holy Covenant, end quote. And then verse 31, quote, they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength and take away the daily sacrifice and place the abomination that makes desolate, end quote. And when they put up the statue of Zeus right there in the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem, it made the place so desecrated in the eyes of any pious Jew that he would not even think of going into the temple. Now we go on to verse 32, which tells us something about the beginning of the Maccabean revolt. Verses 32 to 35 tells how the people, at least some of them, rose up against Antiochus IV, and they succeeded a little bit, and others joined them that weren't really thoroughly with them, but in the end, the Maccabean revolt did free Judea, and it made Judea an independent kingdom or state for about a century. Yet the leadership of Judas the Maccabee, who was the first great warrior of the Maccabees, his leadership was quite mixed. Now, to put this in a little bit more modern terms, suppose somebody back in 1750 made the following prediction, quote, there will be a great ruler who will rise up in one of the countries of Europe, and he will lead armies making rapid marches across most of Europe and conquer many countries, and take great wealth, but he will be completely defeated and his regime utterly destroyed, end quote. Well, you could say that that was exactly fulfilled in Napoleon. But then again, you could find that it was exactly fulfilled in Hitler. Well, it may be fulfilled in somebody else yet in the future, but I would have to say that it has to be fulfilled in one or the other. It could be a prediction of Napoleon, or if it didn't fit with Napoleon, you would say it still has to come and would fit the fulfillment in Hitler. Now, somebody could say, quote, well, Napoleon was just a type of Hitler, end quote. That is, Napoleon was merely a symbol of what Hitler would be like. Well, you could also be saying today that Hitler is just a symbol of somebody who is coming 20 years from now. The point is that it seems to me that there is a great danger in that sort of thinking. Now, there are cases in Scripture where we see two things that are related and that are similar but coming at different times. There is sort of a composite picture, one early and one late. But that is rare, and I would be very slow about accepting such things. If you find definite fulfillment of something, I would say it is complete. And so when it says, quote, ships of Kittim will come against them, end quote, well, that might refer to American ships going out towards the Mediterranean during the last war and putting an end to Hitler's regime, but I don't think that ships coming from Qatim really refer to that. It is something more immediate. My feeling is that in almost every case when something is predicted, you look for one fulfillment, not multiple fulfillments over a period of time. Now, of course, there are two exceptions that should be mentioned. One is, if you say there will be many conquerors who conquer many countries, that could include both Napoleon and Hitler because you have used the plural for conquerors. Or there can be a succession. For example, in Deuteronomy 18, the people asked Moses, quote, "What shall we do? How will we know the Lord's will after you are gone?" End quote. And the Lord says, quote, "God will raise up a prophet like unto Moses, and you will hear him," end quote. And after Moses was gone, God raised up a succession of prophets. So the question, how are we to know Moses is God, end quote, the answer is, quote, well, look to God to raise up a prophet who's like him, end quote. And God raised up one prophet after another. And as time went on, the Jews understood that this succession of prophets was what was predicted and would have its culmination in the greatest of all prophets. And so they said to John the Baptist, "Are you that prophet? Are you the one?" And of course, they were referring to this passage in Deuteronomy 18. In effect, the Jews were asking John the Baptist, "Are you the end to this succession of prophets that are coming after Moses?" But in general, I say look for one fulfillment of any statement that is given in the prophets. That is a little aside, I admit, but it relates to our whole subject, so thanks for your question and for listening to what I had to say. But let's move on. We do want to get on with our discussion of Antiochus, and again I repeat, when it comes to Antiochus IV, I will have more to say about him more specifically in our next lecture. But here I'm giving an overall history of what is going on. And so we have these very remarkable fulfillments of the history tracing right up through and telling us about Antiochus III, and at length telling us exactly what his son, Seleucus IV, and finally telling us about his other son, Antiochus IV, in considerable detail. We have all these things which, when the events occurred, you would see how it would fit, but you would not know in advance the details of God's plan. Well, so much for Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, number 5 in the outline is, quote, Daniel chapter 11 verse 36 to chapter 12 verse 3, end quote. As I pointed out to you a few minutes ago, we have, as I gave under number 3 of the outline, the character and succession of Antiochus Epiphanes in verses 21 to 24. Now we go back again to the description of the character of a king in verse 36 and following. And I say a king for the following reasons. We have Antiochus's political activities in verse 25 to the first part of verse 30, and then we have the political activities of the king again given in verses 40 to 45. We have trouble and relief for God's people in verses 30 to 35 and in verses of chapter 12, verses 1 to 3. We have a section that could very well be called, quote, trouble and relief for God's people, end quote. Now, of course, the holders of the critical view insist that verse 36 and on is still talking about Antiochus IV. We are still talking about him, they say. But it is strange, yet not impossible, that verse 36 on tells all over again what we already heard about earlier concerning Antiochus IV's character. And after we've been told these things before, here it is repeated again. It is strange, maybe not impossible, but it is strange to have such stuff repeated over and over again. But that is not impossible. But I don't think it fits. Most of what is said here in verse 36 on has no precise fulfillment in Antiochus Epiphanes, whereas the previous verses do. And so the critics are in great difficulty when they say that verses 36 of chapter 11 up through verse 3 of chapter 12 are still talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. And so we have this question. This passage, if it is not talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, then whom is it speaking of? And in his commentary, Edward J. Young, to which I have referred to previously, speaks of this section and says that there have been many interpretations of these passages, or these verses. Again, chapter 11, verse 36, to chapter 12, verse 3. He says, quote, the following are principal interpretations. 1. Antiochus Epiphanes. 2. Constantine the Great. 3. Omar, the great Islamic conqueror, who also conquered and built his palace in Jerusalem. 4. The Roman Empire. And then he says, number 5, and he just uses a general title for number 5, the dispensational interpreters. He goes on to number 6, the Pope of Rome. 7, Herod the Great, that's the same Herod under whom Jesus was born, and then finally, number 8, the Antichrist. And number 8 is the one he insists is the correct one, that is, he feels that Daniel in verses 11:36 to 12:3 is referring to the Antichrist and one who is going to come in the future. So E.J. Young says the Antichrist. This may be called the traditional interpretation of the Christian church. It was advocated all the way back in 400 AD by St. Jerome, and in this he has been followed by many. Now, the term Antichrist is not a particularly good term. The Apostle John says, quote, there are many Antichrists, end quote. Antichrist is a very general term. But here is a specific person referred to in, for example, 2 Thessalonians, where Paul says, quote, there is one of whom Isaiah said that the Lord will destroy him at his coming. One who, it is said, will sit in the temple of God, giving forth that he is a God and should be worshipped. One who, Paul describes as doing parable things before the coming of Christ. And it is quite common for us to refer to this one as the Antichrist. Now you notice that E.J. Young does that when he calls him the Antichrist, and I see no harm in that usage as long as we see that there is no scriptural support for it. The scripture uses the term Antichrist in a more general way for all great enemies of the Lord's work. But you notice a strange thing about Dr. Young's commentary. As I have mentioned, he is very good on many of his treatments in the commentary. There is much that is excellent in his commentary, but he has a very strong prejudice against what he calls the dispensationalist position. And if anyone whom he calls a dispensationalist holds a view, that is almost enough in E.J. Young's mind to condemn the view. And so we notice here on page 246 of his commentary that as the fifth interpretation, he simply gives the general term dispensationalist view, which, of course, are wrong, as are all the first seven interpretations there, and as the eighth, he gives, quote, the Antichrist, end quote. Now, he gives two dispensationalist interpretations. He says, and I quote here, A, the king, verses 36, is the little horn of Daniel 7, who is an apostate not from Judaism, but from Christianity. He establishes his palace in Jerusalem during the Great Tribulation, the last 3.5 years of Daniel's 70th week, end quote. Well, now, that would certainly be the one who would be called the Antichrist. He doesn't use the term Antichrist here. He just says that he is the little horn of Daniel 7, who is an apostate, not from Judaism, but from Christianity. Now, the other so-called dispensational interpretation he gives is, and I quote here, B, he is the Antichrist, not to be identified either with the little horn of chapter 7 or with that of chapter 8. This willful king will be a Jew, and in the midst of the Jewish people. And this Jew will assume kingly honors and be recognized by the Jewish apostates as the Messiah king, and by the Christian apostates as the Antichrist. In the middle of the 70th week, he will come and take his seat in the Jerusalem temple and will claim divine worship, end quote. Now, the only difference between these two interpretations is that one says the man is an apostate from Christianity, and the other says that he is an apostate Jew. But they both agree that he is a man who can be called Antichrist because he is the great enemy of God at the end of this age. And then his eighth interpretation, that is E.J. Young's final interpretation, is that, indeed, Daniel is speaking of the Antichrist, and in that I think he is right. And so I would think it better if he subsumed the two dispensationalist interpretations under number 8 of his outline when he says he's either a Jew or a Christian, but in either case he is the Antichrist. In other words, I don't quite understand why he puts number 5, given his two interpretations, as a separate category from number 8. It seems to be two subcategories of number 8. But he says one dispensationalist view is the Antichrist who is a Jew, and the other is the Antichrist who is a Gentile, and the correct view is that in either case this man can be called the Antichrist. Now, I believe that most Christian interpreters have held that these verses are a description of one who is coming in the future. A very interesting thing, though, in addition to that, about Dr. Young's commentary, in chapter 2, and chapter 7, and chapter 9, Dr. Young is very much against the idea of an unmentioned interval between two great events. But here, in this particular section of Daniel, chapter 11, he has at least 2,000 years without being mentioned between verses 35 and 36, and he seems to be comfortable with an interval here. But of course, the critics assume that verse 36 to 39 are still talking about Antiochus IV or Antiochus Epiphanes. But there is statement after statement in this section that simply does not fit Antiochus Epiphanes. And statements are made about things that he would do that we have absolutely no historical evidence that he did. For one instance, it describes an expedition against Egypt, which is very successful. That is, Daniel talks about an Egypt expedition in verses 36 and 39. But there is no record of a successful Egyptian expedition on the part of Antiochus Epiphanes. So, some who hold the critical view will say that this is a repetition of what already has been said, and that, indeed, Antiochus did make an expedition against Egypt. Others say this describes a third expedition against Egypt, which is not mentioned in any of our histories, as I said before. Well, it would be a little strange if that period he did make a third expedition that wasn't mentioned in any of our histories. And it would be particularly strange since his second expedition was brought to an end so disastrously by the Romans, who ordered him to go back, and that was sufficient to lead him to go back. So if he made a third expedition under those circumstances, we can be sure that the Romans would have come again with a force, and yet there is no historical reference to this. And so, I think we can say that verses 36 to 39 are not referring to Antiochus Epiphanes, but to some future ruler whom we have called the Antichrist. And Young, without saying so, really does assume an unmentioned interval of at least 2,000 years at this point between Antiochus Epiphanes and the future Antichrist. Well, notice that the section ends with a resurrection. That is, chapter 2 of verse 12 says, quote, "Many of them that sleep in the dust shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt," end quote. There is the resurrection there. According to the critical views, this is the vain hope of someone at the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, who wrote the book of Daniel. But if you take it as a true message from God, it runs to the resurrection, that is to say, the end of this section goes all the way from Antiochus Epiphanes jumping to the Antichrist and then going on to the great resurrection that we find so dear in our Christian theology. And so even if there were not this unmentioned interval between Antiochus and the Antichrist, if some of this continued to be about Antiochus, there would still have to be an unmentioned interval somewhere because you jump to the resurrection right then. Now, I don't know how much time we ought to take at looking at points in this that were not fulfilled in Antiochus. That is to say, I'm not sure how much of what is said in verses 36 to 39 and then in the first part of chapter 12 that don't refer to Antiochus we should mention. At any rate, let's take a quick look at verses 36 to 39 where it speaks more about the character of the Antichrist. You notice in verse 36 it says, quote, he shall prosper till the indignations be accomplished, end quote. But Antiochus died while his persecution was still in progress. He did not prosper until it was accomplished. In verse 37, we read, quote, neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, end quote. Well, Antiochus built great temples to the pagan gods and put up monuments to them here and there. Those who hold the critical view try to get around this by saying his ancestors worshipped Apollo, and Antiochus worshipped Zeus, but Apollo was the son of Zeus, so anyone who worshipped Apollo also worshipped Zeus. That's not really a very satisfactory interpretation. Note again the quote, neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, end quote. That seems to imply that there is a disjunct between the gods that Antiochus Epiphanes worshipped and the gods or God that Antiochus Epiphanes is worshipping. That's what suggests what Dr. Young referred to, that he is an apostate from Judaism, or that he is someone with a Christian background who has turned away from it. But it certainly doesn't fit anything in the life of Antiochus. Nor is this person, described in these verses, have the desire of women. Now it is not clear what this means, that he shall not regard the desire of women. Some have said that he destroyed a religious cult in Assyria which could be called, quote, the desire of women, end quote. But there is no evidence of Antiochus ever doing such a thing, and it doesn't fit in with his general attitude towards paganism. We also read, quote, nor shall he regard any god, for he shall magnify himself above all, end quote. Well, Antiochus IV did build a tremendous temple to Zeus in Athens. And he also built great temples in Palestine and in Assyria. And verse 38 says, quote, in his estate he shall honor the god of forces, end quote. And no one in ancient time could have even guessed what that would mean, that he would honor the god of forces. But the god of forces he will honor. What is that? A god whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things, and thus shall he do in most of the strongholds with a strange god. I have just quoted again from chapter 11. Well, to people in ancient times, this would make no sense whatever, because all ancient rulers worshipped some god. But in our day, that is today, it is quite common to find those who do not worship any god. In fact, a third of the world today is held by those who say there is no god except for the god of power. And they say that when, well, was it Winston Churchill who suggested to Stalin at a peace conference that they should have a representative from the Pope? And Stalin said, how many divisions does a pope control? Well, in other words, Stalin only considered how big an army you had, not any spiritual force or power that you would have. And that, of course, is the attitude of the communists. They have completely wiped out religion, well, at least outwardly, in China. No one is allowed to have any outward manifestation of any religion in China. And in Russia, while the church is not legally ruled out, it is in actual practice tremendously persecuted, or we have lackeys in the Christian church that are subjects of communist power. And a part of the belief of those who hold a third of the world, of those in power, is a belief that great many leaders in other countries also have, and this belief is in sheer materialism. It is the god of forces, the god of fortresses. That is the god that they honor. And so this is a very good description of how the character of the Antichrist will be, and it is very different from the character of Antiochus, who really did honor Zeus. But we will not take time to go further with these verses at this point, but we will see that there are specific things said in them for which we find nothing comparable to the life of Antiochus Epiphanes. And so there seems to be a definite jump, an unmentioned interval, between verses 35 and 36 in Daniel chapter 11. And here, from verse 36 to chapter 12, verse 3, is a description of events that occur at the very end of the present age, just before the return of Christ. But, unfortunately, given the time, we will have to discuss this in the future. This is the end of Lecture 10 by Alan McCrae on the Prophecies of Daniel.